Body would be there to take the guts out, you know, then throw the meat in another pile. And the year my daddy quit fooling with Nutris was going to be the year I was going to be advanced to being the one to gut him. And I was glad he quit. So you quit in the right time because I didn't want to gut no Nutris.
So the whole family was involved?
Oh, yes. Everybody was.
Did you come from a big family?
No, I have three sisters and a brother.
Yeah, that's four people.
I think my husband's family, they had seven kids. His family was a little bit bigger than mine. And that's, it was four girls and one boy, and they're like, I think it was two girls and five boys. But you know, we both grew up in the trapping families and the shrimping, and it's just different ways. Because, you know, him being a boy, he was with his daddy going do it. Me, I was just at home helping my daddy do the port at home, but he was going out there in the boats and experience it firsthand, you know?
Sure.
I was just like a helper with my daddy when I was a little girl, but we both...
But I'm sure your mama's generation, they must have gone out with her daddy, because
more than likely,
back in that day, a lot of families went together out to the...
More than likely, I don't know. My mom's dad died when I was just a little baby. She never really told me a whole lot about what he did. The only thing I remember her talking about was they lived at the very end of the Ponachan Road, but across the bay. They had a little store there. Her daddy owned the store. And she would talk about that sometimes, about things about the store, and then like how they used to have to hide the slot machines under the counter and stuff like that. That's all I remember her talking about her dad, as far as...
At the end of the Ponachan Road?
All the way at the very end of the road and across the bayou.
So right there where you go to O.J. Shaw's?
Well, when you go to the island, how you cross the bridge to go
yes.
to the island?
Yeah.
But you don't turn, you go straight.
Straight.
All the way at the very end.
Yep. There's a little grocery store there.
This is years and years
ago. I've heard stories.
The last time I've been down there, and that was a long time ago, you can still see the pilings, because I think it's, I don't know if the store burnt or the storm took it or what, but they still had some pilings, but I'm sure that's gone now. That's been a long time.
Do you remember a company called Bay Junip Oyster Company?
I've heard of it, yeah. Mm-hmm. I remember hearing it. I recognize the name, but
okay.
I don't know anything about it.
Okay. Just curious. You've been excellent, absolutely excellent.
Yeah, well, I'm sure my husband can tell you more stories, like on the experience in himself, you know, with the platforms and stuff. It's just I've heard of them. I know they existed. I've probably seen old pictures in magazines, you know, with Bloom and them, but I've never been to them. I know he has. He could probably tell you exactly how they worked it and everything, but all I know is what I heard. And
sure. Well, we're going to have to try to come back when he's not as busy.
Yeah, that's sometimes hard to do, because he's not the type to just sit around too long. It might be a couple of days, but if it's slow, he'll sit and watch TV, but after a couple of days of that, he's got to find something to do. And usually when he starts something, it takes a few days to do it.
Okay. Well, we thank you so much.
Yes.
No, thank you.
I got a question. I think I know.
Well, like he said, we're just trying to capture. We don't have an agenda. We're just trying to capture the history of Mr. Foray.
Okay, no problem.
So before we get started, I just wanted to get this on tape that it's okay for us to record this. We're going to put it at the universities so people who want to write the history of the industry or study, you know, the coast can use this material, you know, whether it's going to be in books, articles, or... documentaries, whatever.
And well, whatever I can do to help, you know, I'll do it. But I mean, it may not come out exactly like you may want to have it, you know.
Oh, no.
We're Cajun down here. We speak different than y'all. Most of the Cajun, like I do and everything, I don't even finish my sentence. I don't pronounce my word exactly right. We just raise like that. This is the way of talking, you know.
Well, this is what
I mean,
we want.
Just, we start in English, sometimes we finish in French, you know.
All right. En français, c'est comme tu veux. Okay. We simply want to begin at the beginning, going back to your earliest experiences with the dried shrimp industry, and we'll just work our way up to the present and see how it's changed over all that time. So when did you first become involved with shrimp drying?
In the shrimp dried, I started in business in 1968. And from there, I just kind of grew up and found out. But my father-in-law was in the dry shrimp business over water. He had a shrimp drying platform like around Seabreeze area. Mm-hmm. And from there, it just kind of built in. And as a kid, we had just this little area over here, Coker Reel. When I started in business, you had like about 10 shrimp drying platforms right in this little area over here. And even when I was young, you know, out of school or vacation and stuff like that, or in the afternoon, I would go and help with it. I just got into it, and what can you do, you know, with it? And, you know, as I got out of school, in other words, I started shrimping with my father and everything else. Then I got into business of my own with shrimping. And like I say, in 1968, there was an old friend of mine that I did business all the time, and he offered me this place, and I took the place over, and from there, it just gradually grew little by little.
Now, before that, you were shrimping on your own?
I was shrimping on my own before that, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And what were you doing with the shrimp? Were you taking them to drying platforms?
Yeah, when I started into the business, there was no ice. That was just, everything was drying, you know. You would just go out without any ice in the morning and then come back in around 10, 11, 12 o'clock, and they would cook the shrimp and dry. And that's how the process was. And through the years after that, late 40s, early 50s, and it started having some people that started coming out with trucks and start trucking shrimp to some of the processing plants. You see. They always had some processing plant, but it wasn't the way they're done right now. People would go out with that boat, and they would camp out, and you had other freight boat that would go out there with ice, and you would go and throw like 10, 11, 12 o'clock, and you sell the shrimp to the boat, and they would ice them up, and when they had that load, well, then they would bring it in and over to the processing plant. And that's how the process really started on the ice business stuff. Mm-hmm. But the system of dry shrimp is a whole different ballgame. There's a lot of people that take credit for something down the line, and they always forget one part. The American Indian was the first one that really started with all of that. And you don't ever hear about that, you know. It's really blow my mind why they don't talk about it. They give all the credit to the Chinese and the Filipinos and everything else, which they did a big part on it. They didn't come over here and show the Cajun how to dry shrimp. The Cajun learned from the American Indian. Mm-hmm. And it was not in the process of selling. All they were doing, the only way of, but there was no idol there. They would catch shrimp, they would dry it on their yard on some board or even whatever they could find, or tarpaulin, whatever they could find, they would dry that shrimp. And they would keep that for their own use, or they would trade it with somebody else, in other words, for other grocery bill. And they just a chain reaction on how to survive with that. And they came along with the Chinese and the Filipinos and everything else. Then they started building big old platforms. And then they started buying shrimp from the Cajun. And they started, and actually what they did, the Filipinos and the Chinese, they started a market for it. Mm-hmm. That's what the market really started. They started by, and it was very cheap though, the way they were told to me and everything else. And as it went on, it kind of grew back itself, and then some of the American people started building their own shrimp drying platform. And again, it come back, like we were talking about Mr. Louis Bloom. The dad of Leopold was one of the big wheels of buying a lot of dry shrimp. And it just went on and on. And then, a few years after that, we had another old man by the name of Mr. Roy Piku, which he's played a big role in there. And
you talked about his role. What exactly did?
Well, Mr. Roy Piku. Well, he started at selling vegetables, and what he did with the vegetables and everything else, and then people didn't have any money, so what he do with that? He'll trade vegetables for shrimp, and he'd go out and he'd sell shrimp, and he was selling to the Chinese and everything else, to Mr. Hoy and everything else. And then gradually through the year, he got built enough to where he started on. I used to call him the king of the dry shrimp, Mr. Roy. I mean, without him, I wouldn't be nothing to them. I mean, he really made me. Him and I were real good friends. And he bought, thousands of pounds of shrimp that guy bought. And he had like all these platforms over water, they were all selling shrimp to Mr. Roy. I mean, they were drying for him. And everything was brought by boat. I mean, there was no vehicle. He had a little warehouse, I guess about 17 miles from here. And all of his product was by boat they were bringing up. He probably had 20 or 30 shrimp drying platforms selling shrimp for him over water. And he would go over there and he would finance it for them and everything. And people would have no money, you know. Mm-hmm. So he'd just go ahead and these shrimp drying platforms, when they go out to buy shrimp, well, he would give them money for them to start buying shrimp. But they come in, and when I have to sell the dry shrimp to him, he'd take his money back out. And it was a family, what it was, because these guys over water, like, they would live with their families. And they would go there sometimes 2 or 3 months without even coming in. They just stayed at the shrimp drying platform. They had camp. They had all the food they wanted right there.
That's a question we all wonder about. It's just how many people were there on a typical platform? Because I know that they had camps
all the way around.
All the way around. Yeah.
The guy that owned the platform might have 3 or 4 employees with him, but everybody that was trolls, they had their families over there. They would all pitch in together, help cook the shrimp, dry the shrimp, peel the shrimp and everything. They would all work together as a group. That's why they would work, you know.
And they would be there for both seasons?
Oh, for both seasons, yeah. You had like your brown shrimp season that would stay. Your brown shrimp season was always in our area over here. And then these same people that had shrimp drying platform in our area over the coast over here had some a little further to the west. Like you go toward Morgan City. Mm-hmm. Not exactly Morgan City, but right before you get to the Shafalow River, which is called Pointe aux Fers. Well, right there, they had a bunch of them right there. And from there, you had Osterweide. Osterweide had probably 8-10 shrimp drying platform. Then you had Bayou Hero right there. It was like a city over there. They had so many. I don't know how many platform there, but it was a silly. I mean, there's just a lot of people that was right there. And like I said, they all worked together.
Well, that's, you just told us something that we didn't know about all the platforms west of here.
West of, the reason the shrimp was to the west, our shrimp is always on a migration. Shrimp migrate during the winter to the west. So it gets to a point that this area here, you always had some shrimp, but the shrimp was kind of scarce, not enough to run the shrimp drying platform with, but they had shrimp drying platform over to the west part of us, which is still Terrebonne Parish. And as the shrimp migrated west, well, the people grab up that boat and the equipment there, and they move back further west. They would work, and they would work that probably till probably March, you see. And our area over here usually stop around, you know, December. Sometimes we had January, but most of the time in December, our shrimp would stop around. And the condition of the weather and everything else. So we don't have the winter that we used to have. We used to have some serious bad winter. And the winter was what really moved our shrimp to the west. And as these guys were doing it in that area, it's amazing. I mean, you can't explain to it. In those days, there was nobody going with plane and taking pictures. But if we would have that, that would be something that would be very interesting to have on it.
So basically, there were platforms
scattered all over the coast, all over the coast. Yeah.
Do you remember, and it would be your grandfather or your father telling you, when you built a shrimp over water, and it was a period before ice, how did they do that? How do you just go out there with wood and build a platform?
A lot of these people were living out there. They were living out there. My father was raised in Baie Saint-Alene. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Baie Saint-Alene.
Saint-Alene, that's where my father was raised at. It was all land over there and everything else.
So you would put in a piling by hand?
By hand. Well, it wasn't no big piling. It was just all a little bit of stick. All they did was just cut board up and just stick and do it.
And then how big would most of these platforms be?
Well, it started on a small scale. But then it got to a point that some of these platforms, like the one we're talking about, to the west of us, in other words, around Osterweide, by here and there, some of these platforms was probably, hard to say exactly, I'd probably have to say 100,000 square feet. I mean, huge thing. They could go over there and put, though there they wouldn't go by the pound, you know, they would go by the tub all the time and everything. And some of these platforms would hold like 2,000 tubs of shrimp that they would hold. That was 105 pounds, you know. And you look at, that is some serious shrimp that, you know.
Why, yes.
That's some serious. And, you know, there's a lot of time in the condition of the weather, you can dry shrimp to a certain extent, and then the condition of the weather comes, and like during the summer month, you can ball shrimp in the morning, you can go ahead and peel them in the afternoon. But sometimes you get cloudy weather where then you just, or it's getting rain, you start drying them, then you have to pick them back up, then spread them back out. So sometimes it would take 2 or 3 days, you know. Mm-hmm. And during the winter month, you never could make it in 1 day. It always was 2 days plus, sometime a week before you could do all that. But you could save them. 1 day will cure with that salt balling and with that salt and everything else. Your shrimp is cure. So once you got enough sun in to take
it's
some of the water.
Take the moisture out.
Take the moisture out, yeah. Yeah, as long as you could get, you know, 50-60% of the moisture out, they would still keep on drying themselves on there, you know. And that's how they would do that. And then when the weather would get real hot, like you get a real good front that would go through, and they would come out into it, well, then they would dry up, then they'll spread everything out and get them real hot, and then pile them back again. It's just like body heat. If you put them together, the heat will stay together right there. And I've seen people beat shrimp around the clock after it was like that, just, you know, or peel them, should I say, peel the shrimp in the machine.
Now these platforms had...
Yeah, they were made into a road. They would start to go over the road and come up. The reason it was like that, so when you had a bar across with them, topolium. So when you put them on, pile up your shrimp underneath that and you put a topolium on, the water would fall, it would fall away for them.
Mm-hmm. It just drained away.
Right. If it's be flat, what would happen, your shrimp would get wet. Mm-hmm. Then when they get wet, in other words, they'll spoil on you.
Well, how often did that happen? How often did people lose shrimp?
Oh, it happened. It happened a lot of times. The mm-hmm. shrimp was cheap those days, and it really didn't make that much difference. And they lost a lot of shrimp, but really throw them away, it wasn't that bad. Because what they did, it was an off-gray shrimp, mm-hmm. whatever it is, and they wouldn't come out pretty. It had like a black-looking color to it, and it had a little odor in it. And that was always sold on a market, on a different scale on a market. Most of these people that would use that kind of shrimp, even it was sold like in Mexico, even was sell, a lot of the stuff was selling in Cuba. Cuba was buying the garbage. Mm-hmm. And they would sell the Cuba stuff later. So, yes, they lost shrimp, but not on a big, big scale. You never lost that whole platform for them. They might lose, you know, maybe a couple of hundred tubs, or should I say, you know, 10,000 pounds.
That's a small percent
it was at that time. And shrimp was so cheap, but they were buying shrimp like a dollar a tub, you know. With 100 pounds of shrimp, you know, so.
So okay, so you've dried the shrimp, Mr. Foray, and then what? The shrimp's dry.
Right.
How do you get it to Mr. Piku?
Mr. Piku, well, after it was dry, well, when I started in business, there were vehicles those days, so he would come and pick them up himself in his truck. Mm-hmm. After we had them all dry and we had them in the peeling machine while we peel them and everything else, you just had the shrimp left. That would have, you know. And it takes you about 7 pounds, but actually to make a good quality, it takes about 8 pounds of fresh shrimp to make you a pound of dry shrimp. Mm-hmm. And so the percentage of it would very small for him to pick up at that point. And we would put that in some 100-pound burlap sack, and he would bring it to his warehouse, and from there, he would take it and run it to his, first thing they do, they'll pick them up, run to a blower and pick all these, you know, you always have some little trash in there left. And from there, then he would grade it to a different size, and then he pack them in boxes and shift them all over. You know.
These were coffee sacks? A
coffee sack, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any idea how they got them? I mean, they just bought them, the leftovers from the coffee dealers in New Orleans, or?
Well, they used to come in pallets. Yeah, they were all new sacks.
Oh.
Yeah, they were all new sacks. And I'm sure there were some of them because I did see some of them that I had that had some coffee green in it. You know. Mm-hmm.
You talked about the shells early and getting all of the trash out.
Yeah.
I know in the old days people used to dance the shrimp on the platform, but when did the beaters start
the
coming
beaters
in?
The beaters really started coming out, if I can remember. That was before my time, too, but it was in the 30s. Or so. Late 20s or early 30s that they started there. And it's made a beater, which is just, you've probably seen what it is. It's still in the same system, they never changed that. They were, you know, made a little different name to it in the way of peeling and everything else, but it's still almost in the same system that it was originally started with.
So you were talking about the number of platforms that they had here when you started.
Yeah.
Now, as you moved up the bayou, about how many were there altogether that you remember when you started along the bayou?
You see, well, that's a lot of time we talk about coquetry. I was born across the bayou right here at Coquitree. Crocodile was always from me, from Savannah Canal, which is about a mile and a half from here, 2 miles from here, I guess, from here, coming down to the end over here. That's what Crocodile. Now they call Crocodile all the way to Boudreaux Canal. So I'm not knocking nobody here, you know. Crocodile is what we're standing right now.
Right. We're trying to figure out how many there were along the bayou heading up toward.
We had shrimp drying platform that I remember up until, last one that had a shrimp drying platform that was further up was like, Mr. Norris Price, but when he moved up, it wasn't dry, it was with dryers at that time, you know. We had the Blanchett family there, they had shrimp platform too, which was just a little about a couple of miles below from where Mr. Norris Price's place at right there they were. We had the old man Toussaint Fourier that had a shrimp drying platform in that area too.
Do you remember places like Coon Road and Seabreeze? Because we've read that there were platforms that.
Yeah, in Coon Road, they had the biggest platform in our area was in Coon Road. It belonged to Roland Chauvin, the Chauvin family. That was a huge platform. You can't even get to where that's all over water right now.
But if you left Cocodrie going south. How far would you have to go to get to Coon Road?
Coon Road, about 5 miles.
And how about at Seabreeze?
Seabreeze is about the same thing, about 5 miles. Yesterday, maybe not even quite, like the crow flies left at 5 miles.
And was there platforms there too?
Yeah, there was a lot of platforms at Seabreeze. They had I can't remember the name of everybody, but I remember Tony S. Foray, which was my father-in-law. He had one there. Tadley Spellegrant had one right there. O'Neill Seven, he had a shrimp drying platform there. And he had several of them that I just can't think right off the bat.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Mr. Norris Price and them was in that neighborhood too. His dad, Stanley Price, had a platform in that area. Right there.
How about the Laperouse family?
The Laperouse family, they were right by the crossroad of that right here. Terry Laperouse still does a little drying right when you get the Bill Robinson Canal to your left, right here past there. Well, that's what Terry Laperouse did. He still got the few drive. He just drive to sell in the store right now. But his daddy was Lester Laperouse, and the other Laperouse was Chester Laperouse. There were two brothers, and that daddy really started to build. They were right where the crossroads goes to Dulac. Are you familiar with that?
Mm-hmm.
Right across the little store, Cecil Laperouse. Mm-hmm. Well, that store right on the north side. That's why that shrimp drying platform, the Laperouse. I believe that that daddy name was Octave Laperouse.
Now, when you go towards Dulac, on the Dulac Road.
Okay.
You come around and you go up over the bridge.
Right.
And right there, there's a cement platform.
That was a waste of time. They tried that. They also had a shrimp drying, cement drying platform over in Grand Island. The reason they did not perform like wood does, because wood will dry and it'll, you know, because we got to go into it in the process of, when you got shrimp on the plank, you got to go down and kind of make a road in it, because, you know, the sun will draw water out of the shrimp one way, and then the plank on it also draws the water
from the bottom.
So that's when you're making a road in, so your platform will draw back when you turn back your shrimp again, so you're sucking from both sides. Well, your concrete don't do that. Your concrete is over mud. Concrete will solve the water from the mud. So what it does, it'll dry the top side of your shrimp. And then when you turn it back over, it takes longer to dry them. And it was very, very, if you had any kind of humility in it, you couldn't even peel your shrimp because your shell wouldn't get crusty into it. I mean, it worked, but it wasn't like the cypress plant.
So most all the platforms are made of cypress?
Cypress.
Again, do you remember, we have two questions about cypress. First, where did it come from? I mean, you've already outlined what could easily be 80 to 100 platforms,
yeah.
Easily.
In the whole court, I would say they had that.
And so if a plank is 6 inches, that's a lot of cypress.
Yeah.
The other thing is, we know that the first boilers were wood-fired.
Right.
Again, if you got 80 platforms, somebody is delivering
lots of wood.
But we can't find anything out about who was involved in delivering the cypress for the platform and the wood for the boilers.
Well, we had a lot of sawmill. Most of that lumber came from Raceland, Chacahula, that area right there. There was a lot of cypress. Cypress wasn't no problem. You could get all the cypress you wouldn't get. You know.
Okay.
That was no problem whatsoever. You even have, that was before my day and everything, like Lake Boudreau, all around Lake Boudreau, that was, it was all cypress in that area. Too. So that was no problem. And a lot of the wood that they would use to ball was mostly oak. We had oak trees all over the area. I mean, we had oak trees at Cocodrill one time. They only had two or three of them left and everything. So that's where the lumber came for that. You had trees all over. The Barry Island was full of trees in years ago and everything else. So lumber never was a problem.
Now, do you remember when the shrimpers had flags?
Yeah.
Well, that's something Carl and I'd like for you to talk about. What was flag?
Well, what it was, the boat that had the flag was the freight boat. Mm-hmm. And you had several different companies that would do that. Every company had a different type of flag. So you know which flag, which one that you was going to do business with. You know? That's what the flag was all about.
Do you have one? A flag?
No, I don't have one.
Have you ever seen one?
Yeah, I've seen some of that flag, but I don't remember that. Mostly it was just... A lot of the flies, they were made because your salt used to come in sacks itself. You know,
okay.
And those are the stuff that they would use for flag, and they would just paint a little decoration on it.
All right.
That's all it was. It wasn't nothing fancy. And some people had them, you know, American flag, you know, but I mean, they always had their American flag because they believe in that, you know. But that flag was mostly like I'm talking about.
Okay.
Some people had a flag, all they had was a sack. Some people had they used to call them Chinese baskets, you know, in other words. They wasn't like the tubs or something like that. It was just big old, when they first started, it was made out of palmetto and stuff like that, those baskets. And then they come back and went to metal baskets and everything else. And so many people, all they do was just flip a basket over in that mass up there and let them know that. That's,
That'll work.
Yeah, that's all they was. I mean, stuff.
But it's hard to find out. We read these little notes. We don't know what that means.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, it wasn't no big process. Just like the ice. Right now, you go to a plant and you get your ice, which I do have an ice plant just a little bit further from right here. And you get that ice plant, and you go over there, and you just blow whatever ice you want. It's already crushed. But it used to come in 330-pound block ice. And they would put that inside of that hole. And they had some little flat boat kind of a made, you know, made out of cypress. It might be maybe 2 feet wide, maybe 4 or 5 feet long and everything else. And they would take that ice pick and they would break that ice by a smaller piece, maybe like 25, 50-pound block, and they put them in that. And then they had a whatever it would be called, and I believe it was like a crusher, and you just take it with a handle and you just crush it up just like you do with an ice pick, you know. And that's the ice that they would use, the ice of that shrimp. So it wasn't easy to...
How often did the freight boats go out into the...
Well, they always, every day you had them going back and forth. You know, you had some that was out there when he was full, the other ones come back. And
they just crossed back and forth.
And what companies were involved in the delivery of the freight?
Well, they had different people that had their own boat, but they would bring like the Engine Ray Shrimp Company.
Okay.
You had Chauvin Brothers. Mm-hmm. They were there. In Homer, you had several of them, like Batu Sherami and all that. He would do. And I just can't think of all these, but anyhow, there was a lot of other people in that area that was coming in.
But we've been told Batu Sherami was a character.
Batu Sherami, yeah. Yep, he was the king of everything, especially oysters. He was a big in oysters.
Now, were you ever an oysterman?
I did that too.
Okay.
I did that.
Hang-tong?
Hang-tong, fish would hang. Fish by hand or off tongue, or lately it was with drudge, you know.
But you hand tongued and fish by hand?
I hand tongued them too. That was fun, though. That was nice. That,
well, tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. Well, my family, like my father, he wasn't a shrimper here. He didn't start shrimping until the late 40s. He was an oysterman. His daddy was an oysterman. They were living over in, the, like I said, Bay Santa Lena, we're talking about. And they would go over there and they would fish oyster. It was all oyster turns and everything. They would live right there. I mean, that was their home. And they would go over there and they would fish oyster for maybe 4 or 5 days. And they had a reef. They call it a clean reef, you know, where there was no oyster. And they had a clean reef. And as they catch the oysters, instead of leaving them on the boat, because oyster was on dock. So every day they would go back and they put them on that. And what they would do, so the drum, big the drummer's an enemy for us. They'll lead the orchestra. What they'll do, they'll take like some wire, like hog wire and everything else, and they'll make a fence off of a reef, maybe the size of this over here, something like maybe 50 by 50, 60 by 60, something like that. And they will throw back the orchestra on that reef right there. And when they get ready to go to the market with it, they'll go back and put the boat right next to it, get them with the orchestra time again, put them back on that boat again.
Now, how did you deal with the big Arno?
The big Arno? Well, the big Arno was a problem those days, too, yeah. But anyhow, they put that boat in and bring it to the market. But like I said, they wouldn't leave them long enough that for the big Arno to damage them right now.
Okay.
Because they'd only be there for a week or so, you know.
Okay, well, I didn't know. Yeah. I'm from up around Apollos.
Yeah, well, the big Arno, what they would do with the big Arno, they would go into that reef. And what they would do is, like, the time, like, probably March, April, and May, that area right there, they would take palmettos, and they would tie them up on some pole, and they would drive that in that reef. And then being those, they would come up there, and they'd lay their eggs over there. So what they would do while they were up there, they'd go out with their skiff and just pull the pole out, and then they'd shake that in the boat and get the being those out of there, and then they'd let them put them on that so they could dry. You know? So they weren't that stupid.
No, yeah. It was ingenious.
Yeah, yeah.
If your family lived at Lake Bay St. Helene,
yeah.
Were they survived all the hurricanes?
Yeah. Well, those days it was a lot higher than what it was right now. I mean, land didn't sink a lot. When I was a kid, right here is Cocodrie right there. I mean, we're below sea level now. We probably was about 4 feet high, the land where we was right now. It all went down. When the oil companies started coming down here and everything, they started digging. But my father, like I said, he was living over in Bess Annalene. And from Bess Annalene, in other words, and then through the coastal erosion and everything else, and then the hurricane, like you said, everything else. So they moved a little bit further up, which further up was probably 2 miles. It's called Bay Trois-Saint-Piquet. It was a totally enclosed bay, which was my grandfather's oyster reef. And they got a name, Trois-Saint-Piquet, was because Piquet is a stick.
You're right.
And he had 300 sticks scattered around in that thing, right in that pond. Right? And it was a closed-in bit. And all he did was cut a little bay across it so he could go with that skiff and fish oysters in that area. Right? That's how he got his name. If you look on the map, Trois-Saint-Piquet, that's how he got his name.
Mm-hmm.
And from that, he moved from there. And then a few years after that, again, the hurricane moved him a little bit further up, which is, again, probably another 2 miles further up, maybe not that much, you know. And then from that, they moved to Cocodrie.
Yeah. While we're on the subject of hurricanes, I've heard the old folks along the coast talk about the signs that they knew when a hurricane was coming. Can you talk a little bit about that?
They thought they knew. Well, it's the only way they knew there was a hurricane. When it was, I mean, it was there. That was it. It was there. You know. So they really, it's, what is the answer? I don't know, but it's just the idea that.
They at least believed in you.
Yeah. They are over there in this condition of the weather, how it was, and tide rise and everything else. They know it's time to leave. But most of the time they didn't leave. They stayed over here.
But when they did leave, where did they go?
Just right, with the leave from Bay St. Helene, they come to Cocodrie. They're like the people of Cocodrie will used to leave go to Chauvin. It's amazing how things change, you know, through all the year. When I was a kid, right here at Cocodrie, we had about 400 people living. We only got, let's see what we got right now. Got my nephew and his wife, one of my cousins, and there's another friend of mine, so that's before. And then we got five. We got about 6 people, the 2 residents of Cocodrie that get their mail to Cocodrie. Of course, I still get my mail to Cocodrie. I shouldn't say that, yet, but I don't really live here no more. You know, I live in Chauvin. I used to tell people, my wife lives in Chauvin, my family lives in Chauvin, but I live in Cocodrie. But anyhow, that's how the system was in that area right there. And then through the year with the hurricane, people started moving further up. Just like people over water moved over here, people in Cocodrie kept moving up. Now, if we would have the regulations that we got today, if you want to build, you got to elevate your camp up. If they'd have done that 40, 50 years ago, we still have a lot of people living at Cocodrie. Because the answer to that is elevate your camp, the hurricane comes, water goes underneath. Those days, people had that, it was all small camp, and they were almost on the ground, they were 2 or 3 feet high, they put them. But when a hurricane would come, well, not exactly that every time it would wash away. they, what they would do, every one of them room, they would cut a hole in the floor 2 feet by 2 feet. When a hurricane come, you just pull that plug out, and the water comes in, and the water go back out. There was no insulation, nothing like it to this world, you know. And that's how they survived through all of that. But people kept moving, going to shore. Some went to home and everything else. Now, these people that are still alive wish that they would have stayed at Cocodrie, because they're in worse shape at Chauvin now than they was at Cocodrie. But when we get a hurricane at Cocodrie, you can come the day after the hurricane, you can come at Cocodrie. There's no more water. You got a mess, you got mud in your yard, but there's no more water. But when you get to Chauvin or home or stuff like that, it's all on the levee. Once the levee breaks over, you got a bathtub. It takes 3 or 4 weeks before it dries up. So they're in worse shape being inside the levee than if you wasn't outside the levee.
So all the people that are, all the buildings that are over here, these are all camps for people that live somewhere else?
Yeah. All recreation took over.
Right. And where the owners live mostly where? In Houma, New Orleans?
No, they all over there. Anywhere from Houma, New Orleans, Baton Rouge, and you name it, Monroe, and some out-of-state people that have got camps there.
Yeah. Well, we wondered about how many people actually lived here. We were counting mailboxes coming down the other day.
Well, a lot of the people with the mailbox down here are some of them that have no recreation camp that still got their mailing address over here. So they'll come in and spend the whole summer, so many people down here.
Do you ever remember hearing stories about the market hunters, the people who were making, you know, it was legal to hunt? We have, Carl and I found a reference that Chauvin was one of the largest producers of feathers for women's hats.
Yeah.
But we haven't found anybody that knows anything about.
Well, I can just tell you what it was told to me and everything else.
Perfect.
That's all I can tell you. I mean,
that was before my time
and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
You had people from all over that used to come down with freight boats and spent times over here just to go hunting in Cocodrie. People would, they was young because that was buku duck in our area over here, and they would go and they'd just kill it, and it was for the market. I mean, I'd seen pictures, I don't know, through the hurricane we lost all through, but I've seen, piles of duck. I mean, they had that hanging around their boats and you name it. But that was a market for it, you know. It's a funny thing. Anything that got a dollar involved in it, they're going to ruin it. Money corrupt people.
Well, while we're on that subject and we're talking about things before your time, do you hear any stories about people bringing whiskey in?
Yeah.
During Prohibition?
Yeah, during Prohibition. This is a little interesting, that thing right there is. Because the place that they used to storage it was Baudouin Island, which is totally gone now. It was an island called, they had people living there, oyster people and everything else. And at that time, Whiskey Pass was a very small pass. And these people would come in, and they would go ahead, and they couldn't bring in. They would hide their whiskey on Baudouin Island. And all of these Cajuns around here, what they would do with that, they would go at night and everything else and get all together with the people that were watching everything, and they would go there and steal that whiskey.
With the whiskey that was on the island, how did it make its way in?
By boats.
By boats? And would they take it to Chauvin?
They would take it all over. Mm-hmm. They would take it all over. It was, my dad used to tell me those stories. It was something else. Baudouin Island was the place that they used to store it.
And they bring it in from the boats off the coast?
From the coast, yeah.
And these were shrimpers that would go out and get it?
Well, you had all these freight boats that were traveling all the time, you know. I mean, from all over the area that would come. We had a lot of the people that used to, years ago, they used to travel all the way from Mexico all the way to Spain, and that's the area that they would travel all over this area right here. The reason they would travel this area over here, because there's an island that we have, which is called, it's not an island no more, it's called Ship Shoal, which was a big old island, they tell me, years ago. And you had your Barry Island over here, which was a pass, which was a deep pass in between there, and it was a shelter, but it gets a lot of salt wind. The Ship Shoal itself is probably, by looking at the map of how wide it was and everything else, what the sandbars and everything else, it's probably 15, 20 miles long. So that was an island, big island that was right there, and they would come right there and That's why all the treading was made out of everything.
Well, that's fascinating.
I mean, it is. It's fascinating. Yeah. When you talk about a freight boat, how big was a freight boat?
They weren't as big as what it sounded like it was. You had small ones. You had some of them that probably was. I remember some of the freight boats in my days, they probably was, 70, 80 feet long, But they were flat boats. They wouldn't draw much water and everything else. They had big cabin on and everything else. And what these freight boats would do, in other words, a lot of them freight boats would leave from New Orleans. And they would come down by Lafourche and everything else. And it would bring a lot of the groceries and everything else. And they would sell the groceries to the people along the canal.
Okay.
And a lot of time, what they would do and everything else, these freight boats, because occasionally they didn't have any money, they would swap something back and forth for groceries.
Sure.
And that's how
it
was all trade and everything. And these freight boats would come and they'd go all the way to the island. We had like our Barrier Island, we had used to be a buyer that goes all the way across. I hate to tell you all of this stuff over here because I can refer me in the future what I'm doing, working on. I'm going to tell you some of the stuff. Anyhow, it's going to, you had to buy it all the way to the last island. The whole island, which was the big island. Now you got whiskey, you got several cut all the way across. And you had that, when it would go across that buy, you had like Trinity buy, you had a hog buy, you had Trinity buy, but that was a mean buy that was to the island, just like the buy that you have over here, but it was going through. Because this buy over here used to go all the way through. All the way, and you could ride that thing. Even they went, that was again before my dad, when my grandfather told me that his daddy used to go to the last island on horseback, covered wagon, everything else.
God.
So, there was people all along the buy. And they get to it, and then they had the buy going to. And that buy was that whole buy goes all the way to the where we call Coon Point. But when they get to a session, I used to call Village Buy. That's a village that was a lot of people living right there. And when the French would call it Bayou de Village. And it would go all the way across from there, and then it goes back across, and it would be land, goes all the way to Bayou de Lord, which come back all the way. It was all land over there.
Well, that's something I want to talk to you about before we leave today, is about how all this has changed. Because it's amazing that, you could go by horse, you said even by wagon.
By wagon. Even in my days, now there was no wagon, but I remember in my days the land that we had in our area. You just had a couple. If you go right here across, you just look at the little cut they got called Pascoca Drill, a little bit. It was, you had, and there was a small boat those days when that was made. You couldn't turn around. If you were trolling, you had to go back and turn around the bay and then you come back again. That's how narrow it was. And then we had the, which we call the Redfish Island. And everything else, I was always with that. And it goes, it's called Paddler Pool. It was area called, there was all land. People were living all along that area. And the word Paddler Pool, it might not even be on the map anymore. The reason they call pool is a chicken in French. And the neighbor was living right there, and there was a little canal that kind of built across over there. And the chicken would jump over there. That's why they call it Paddler Pool. That's how it got its name for that. And now, Paddler Pool was that, and if you look from there, from where go from One Island Pass, come to Randall across, you got about roughly of land right there about 8 miles that was completely gone. That's all water there.
8 miles.
And that's where people were living right there.
So there were people living south of Cocodrie?
Oh, more people than were living at Cocodrie.
And you said there were 400 people maybe living in Cocodrie.
Yeah. At my time, I'm talking about the 40s and the 50s and the 60s. People started moving out after Hurricane Audrey in 57. That's when people started migrating a little bit further. But until that time, we had a lot.
Y'all had a lot of flooding here?
Yeah, we had a lot. We had a lot of flooding. But we didn't have that much damage because the way the camps were built, like I said, everybody had that hole in it with water going in and go back out. The worst thing that I remember for Hurricane Audrey, I was young those days and everything, everybody had butane bottle. Man, that was a big thing. We had butane when we got that. Well, all of that floated away. And always, if you look up there, they got a bunch of trees going on almost to the Dulac on it. Well, that was, we had to go back and pick up all these bottles for this.
Now, how did you get butane?
Well, at that time, we had truck coming down and delivered at that time. That was in the 50s. That was that we were living in high class right now. Oh. We didn't get electricity at Coker Deer until probably 51 or 52.
The rural electrification project, okay.
And when did the roads come through here?
This road over here was the black dock. We had a little gravel road.
Right.
When I was a kid, it was a mud road. Then they mud the gravel. I'm ahead of my game right now. When I was a kid, there was maybe three families that was living on this side of the bay. Everybody lived on the other side of the bay. Everything was by boat. While we sitting right here, there was sugarcane plantation right here. After the finished sugarcane plantation, they were raising corn over here. The other side of the bay was seen with, there was a little refinery, which was before my days. I got to correct that.
A sugar refinery.
She had a little sugar refinery across the bay right here. When I was a kid, we used to go play. They still had the old building, the little part of the old building, some of the old wheels from the refinery and everything right there.
Do you remember the Cordell? Is the Cordell something you remember?
No, I don't remember. I can't remember that.
So it was a mud road?
It was a mud road, yeah. And then after they made the mud road, and then after that, well, that, you couldn't come. I mean, that was told to me and everything mm-hmm. else.
Oh, sure.
That was, the road would stop at Robertson Canal. From Robertson Canal coming down, it was nothing but a dirt road. And it would, and everybody had cattle, or people were raised, or were farming, or whatever they would do. But everybody's property, they had a fence. You had to, gate, you had to get out of the town, you had to get out of that thing right there, open the gate, go back through, close by the gate, come on down.
There were some areas like that where I grew up too, the same thing.
So if you're going up to Bayou, the first canal is Savan?
Well, we on Seaman Canal is on the other side of the bayou now.
All right, and then it's Robinson.
Canal, which is the that's one of the little braided dome. Right.
And then it's Boudreaux Canal.
Boudreaux Canal. Yeah.
And Boudreaux Canal was where the Indian Ridge.
Right, exactly.
All right. Now was that a big cannery?
Oh yeah, it was a big cannery. Yeah. So my brother was a big cannery. So.
Now the one thing we've been real curious about is the cans used in the canning trade.
Yeah.
Now, probably be before your time, but you had dried shrimp.
Right.
And then they had canned shrimp.
Yeah.
Do you remember when we started going from dried shrimp to canned shrimp?
Yeah. Well, that was even before my time and everything else, But that was the only way of, when it started with the canning shrimp, well, that was a big deal, Because that was another way that you could get rid of your product. You just wasn't just dry shrimp. It was another way you could go and get the canning plant. And that's what all these boats were doing, bringing up like an Indian Ranch or whatever. They were canning it. And after they were canned, well, they were cured. They were in pretty good shape. And that went on, that was a lot of canning plant. But that started going sour in the early 80s. That's when our price of shrimp started gradually, it went sky high. And
so that's what put the canneries out?
It put them out of business, yeah. What happened there, you could get imported shrimp at that time, canned shrimp, cheaper than what they could put them in the can. So if I even had the price. If I remember well, at that time, shrimp would sell like a case of shrimp, of canned shrimp, was selling like for $42 a case. That's what it would sell for. And it would cost them $42 a case to put them in the case, which was like 48 cans in there. The Chinese, when they started coming in with the canned goods, were putting on the market like for $21 a case. So they were putting them half the price what it was cost the people of it. And they had a lot of shrimp on hand, so they lost a lot of money and they never could regroup that.
Mm-hmm. With the cans, Mr. Foray, do you have any idea where they were getting the cans from? Were they bringing it in from the East Coast? That was something that was made in Louisiana?
That I couldn't answer. I know it was all imported in, so from where it was made, I have no idea.
Okay.
You have to talk to some of the people that was in the can.
Okay. Well, we just thought maybe you would have...
No, I can't help you on that. I remember all the cans coming in and everything else. You know.
Do you remember the term shrimp nickels?
Shrimp nickels.
No, when the shrimp were peeled by ladies, sometimes children.
Yeah.
They were put in a little cup, and then they were taken to a scale, and they were paid in a local coin.
Yeah.
And there was some that said Indian Ridge
canning company. Yeah. Some said Bloom and Bergeron. Yeah. And it was like a nickel.
Yeah.
And you collected those, and local merchants,
yeah,
like the store at Indian Ridge, would accept those as payment. Yeah. Have you ever seen any of those?
No, I never seen them. my dad, it wasn't using token. My dad, they were using little slip.
Hmm.
Little slip papers and everything else. You got a little slip paper, and you got X amount of a pound of shrimp that you peel, and then you take that little slip and you go in, and then they'll pay you with that slip.
Okay.
They would what they would do into that right there, let's say just like headless and shrimp. They'll take a bucket probably, maybe like a 2 gallon bucket, 2.5 gallon bucket and everything else, and they would pay, well, you probably had so much per bucket to headless that. So you bring your headless there, and you always had somebody, which I did that myself too, And you always had somebody that had one of them knock the holes into your paper. And every time you give them a bucket of shrimp, headless, you take that and you pop a hole in. So after the day was finished, all you had to do was count the little holes, and you know how many buckets of
a shrimp you had.
Yeah. That's how I remember that part. But as far as the coin, though, I don't remember the coin.
The tokens, paper you remember.
I remember the paper, yeah. Mm-hmm. But as far as just like when I was a kid, like across the bayou, we'll get back to the Chauvin again. They had if you go to Cocodile at the end, they got one camp right there. It still belongs to some of the family of Chauvin. Well, right there, the Chauvin had a shrimp drying platform, they had a oyster house, they had a fish house, and a grocery store right there. Mm. Now, I remember that well, because I was born probably 200 feet above from where that camp is at. That's where I was born. I was raised right there. And as a kid, I remember we used to go over there and buy candies or cookies or whatever we wanted to buy as a kid. Well, we didn't have nickels. We didn't have quarters. We had token. Mm-hmm. In other words, it takes 5 token to get a penny. It takes 5 pennies to get a nickel. Well, I remember that well. Token was, again, it was a little round thing. It was made, it was rushed, but whatever metal it was made, it was rushed. And it had a little hole in the middle. And we could go over that. We can go out with token, with 2 token, I can get me a candy.
Do you remember the school boats?
Yeah.
Were they very active?
Yeah, they were pretty active. I never rode in them myself, mm-hmm. But I mean, they didn't, over here, another thing, get back. Right here, that was a little schoolhouse, right? Which I did not go to school there. Before I got ready to go to school there, we had the road over here, so I could go to Woodrow Canal School. So they abandoned this school over here. Right here, where Harbor Lights out, mm-hmm. Right on the little bit on close to the by side, that was a little schoolhouse right there. I remember schoolhouse well. My uncle bought the building from the school board, and he built his house in Dulac with that lumber right there.
Now, the boats, do they run with the putt-putt engines?
Yeah,
in
putt-putt
them?
Yeah. Engines.
Do you remember when they were started putting the Model A? It was a Ford Model A,
yeah.
Four-cylinder Ford. With a flywheel. You remember them?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Was it real?
Even before, you had the old engine, the old Farbank engine and everything else.
And that would be called a gas boat?
A gas boat, yeah. And most of the people, what they had was, someone called Fidiquak, other one had some Farbank engine. And his Farbank engine had a big old flywheel, in fact, 2 double flywheel. That's why he gets his horsepower, And just turn that thing in, and the flywheel the weight of the flywheel would just skip on and on as I get up.
Put.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. My father-in-law has 2 of those.
Yeah.
At his
place. Yeah. Mm. Yeah, those were some engines over there. They left from there, then they went to, then they went to the little bigger there to come in with them little Ford engine and everything, the Model Ford and 4 cylinder and everything else. And then from there they gradually grew up, and then they come out with a Farbank engine, which was a little bit more horsepower. These Farbank with the big flat, they were only 3 and 4 horsepower, and then they went up to like 20 horsepower, 30 horsepower, 40 horsepower. That was a big deal though. And you talk about, how people used to work on that. And I was a kid, remember that well. He had a shrimp boat. And he had a little Model T truck. He had a boat and a truck with 1 engine.
He'd move it through.
Yeah, when you go shrimping, you take the engine out of the truck, put it in the boat, and he go shrimp. When he come back, he take it.
That's doing it right, right? We're going to run over water. Now we're just going to run on land. That's good.
Yeah. During World War II, tire was you couldn't get no what you needed and everything else. And he didn't have no, because all he had is rim, and he had rope ties around this rim and everything. That was his rubber for him to ride on the road. Which it wouldn't make any difference, because the road was so rough, you know, it was a good gravel road. So.
Now, did most of these people sell to either Mr. Piku or Mr. Bloom?
Yeah.
All right, so they were the largest?
They were the largest one that they had right now, yeah. They were. Mm-hmm.
Do you remember people drying fish?
Yeah. Well, I did that, too.
Really?
Yeah, not for the market, but I just did it for my own consumer. You know? Yeah.
But you remember?
So, yeah. They were doing that. They were doing that with the same system that they do it with the shrimp. When there was no shrimp, they had fish, and they were salting them down, you know, and salting them down for 2 or 3 days. And then they get them back out, and they would lay them out on the platform. Some of them had string, put them on string. Other people would just lay them on that platform. Shrimp drive. There was no shrimp, but there was fish. So they could work year-round that way.
And who was buying the dried fish?
A lot of the fish was sold again to the Chinese. Chinese were buying that. And Mr. Louis Bloom's dad and Leopold and all that, they were all doing that.
But it's mostly for the Chinese market, then.
Chinese market, yeah.
Now, you mentioned a China basket. Have you ever seen one?
Yeah, I've seen it. I wish I would have one, but I don't have any more.
Well,
and I'm not sure. Check with Louis Bloom, Skippy. They may have one in that place left.
Okay.
But can you describe them? I mean, what they look like?
They were made, they probably were that big on top, but they were pointed going down. You know, they were maybe that big at the bottom, but they were probably that big on top of them. You know.
How much would they hold about?
Probably hold 100 pounds of shrimp.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Mm.
But I'm not sure, but I think Mr. Lewis and them would have that.
Do you remember when you still had a lot of sailboats?
Some of them, but it wasn't, you know, it kind of got out of that way. But they always had some of them that were sailing.
Now, did your daddy sailboat when he had his oysters? When he went to his clean reef,
yeah,
and he retonged his oysters?
Yeah. That was all the engine those days.
All right, and then where did he take those oysters?
These oysters would go all the way to Bato, Sherami, and Homer. Had to go all the way to Homer. That was a day's ride to go to Homer.
Mm-hmm. And no biggie, no. And he gets to Homer, now what does he do? Does he sell it in a bag, or does he sell it?
No, he sell it buck. They sell it buck. They put them in basket, or when they were steaming oysters, in other words, well, then just go ahead and they would just pay him on the eel, whatever the eel would come out at the end. You see.
So he wasn't putting them in sacks.
No.
He was just putting them on.
They were all buck on the boat. Everything was buck. They all just shove them back out. When they get to home, they all do was shove them back. Either in basket or whatever. They were all in basket. Whatever. They had to put them in basket to bring them back into to the steamer and everything. You know.
About how many pounds in a load?
Well, we'll have to go into sacks. Those days, they probably bring like 400 or 500 sacks, you know, 100-pound sacks, you see.
That boat was pretty low in the water.
Oh, yeah. Well, the way they would load that, these boats, you had that much water on the deck. It was loaded. It was underwater. With the cabinet out there and everything else, it was, with a hole with that and everything else, well, they had board that come up probably 2 feet board that for the cabin and everything else. The cabin was probably 2 feet above the deck and everything, so the water was on the deck. The way the boat was made, not the whole boat was on the water, but the way the boat was made, the middle of the boat, that was on the water.
That's a lot of oysters, and you're just put.
That's what I tell you, take them a day to go to Houma.
And where was the oyster dock in Houma?
It's, let's see if I could. They got all kind of building into that area right there. It was right before you get to the Intercoastal Bridge, where you get the double bridge at.
And by a Terrebonne?
Yeah, by a Terrebonne, yeah.
All right.
But the bridge.
The new bridge?
The new bridge, yeah, where the double bridge is at. Know what, if you be coming back from the west, coming to the east, All coming right. back up, when you go over the intercoastal right mm-hmm. there, mm-hmm. you've probably come maybe a quarter of a mile to your left. That's where it was at, a half a mile at the most right there. I'm trying to figure what building that they would have right now to give you an idea.
So it's
on the opposite side of where Bloom and Badger
yes,
on
yes.
the opposite side. But they also had a place right where Mr. Bloom and them were at. On the opposite side of the bayou too right there. They had an ice plant and everything in there building. That was another place right there though. But Batu was, like I said, just on the same side, like skipping them more, but on the opposite side of the canal.
I got you. Okay. Intercoastal. And then I guess he would get his groceries.
Yeah, you get
and up. Put back.
Put back down, yeah.
And work the lease again maybe for a week.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Okay.
That's all they do.
Hand tonguing, no.
Hand tonguing.
Not a
drudge. No, no drudge. There were no drudge over there. It was all that.
And a small boat.
And a small boat.
About how big?
Well, the boat that I remember that he had was probably about 45 feet, I guess.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't, at that time, it was a fairly good sized boat.
Yes, yes.
But the skiff that they fished the oysters in was almost as big as the boat that they had that day. But they had them, they used to have skiff, and that skiff probably was 30 feet long, and probably 8, 9, 10 feet wide, and they would turn into that boat right there. And when they go up with the oysters and everything else, they also had that boat there loaded with oysters and the boat.
So they'd pull it behind?
Pull it behind, yeah.
Well, who was making all the boats over here?
Everybody made their own boat. They had some people that were carpenters, but most everybody built their own boat.
Did you ever build a boat?
Yeah, built a few boats. Small boats, yeah.
Wooden?
Wooden boats, yeah.
Cypress?
Cypress, yeah.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Hand-caulked?
Yeah, everything was by hand. Well, of course, we had skill saw and stuff like that, but it was all handmade, yeah.
Wow.
The biggest one that I built was 47 feet. I built that in 1963. And I built a few skiffs, you know, smaller skiffs, like 25, 30 feet, stuff like that. You know. For my own use, not to sell, you know. That was my own use.
Now, how did you figure out where to put the, you know, you come off your motor, you got to drive,
yeah.
and then you got the wheel.
Yeah.
How did you figure out where to put the drive line through the hull? Did you just look at it?
Yeah, you know, you just look at it. Did know what side wheel you wanted to turn. So you always go by the side wheel. If you want a little wheel, you got a direction to where it's at. If you want to put a big wheel, you put a little bit more angle in it. Then we used to drill that with, that was by hand. That we used to, big old bit, you know, you just put that. And we was a solid block of iron, or wood we used, you know, like probably like a, what I would use probably about 8 inch, probably about maybe 8 feet long, you know, that wasn't big, but it was made on a wedge, kind of. And then you had to drill that hole.
And you had to get it right the first time.
It never was right. It never was right. That engine never was that set. It always had it. You look at it. If people tell you had it right every time, they lied.
It was almost right.
It was good for what we were doing.
But he'd get up on the step and run.
Oh, yeah. Well, not the big one, but a small one. We built like Lafitte type and everything else.
You
yeah.
built Lafitte skiff?
Yeah, I built Lafitte skiff too. Yeah. Yeah, that would get on the step. Yeah. But that was easy to build that. I mean, everything else. It was all flat bottom and that, you know, and everything. Not no beads and nothing like that. That was just flat bottom. So that was a little thing to do.
Now, when you built a Lafitte skiff, you put an air cooled motor or a water cooled?
Well, when we first started with Lafitte skiff, we had a little engine, a little air cooled engine, so a smaller one. But then as we got bigger, I've gotten to the 25, 30 foot, we were using big engine. We were using Corey engine, the Chevrolet engine and stuff like that. You know?
Yeah.
But our best engine was the 350 Chevrolet, you know.
Yeah.
That was our best engine.
a muscle boat.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I was with the Mr. Bio. He worked for Tenneco, Latere. Yeah. Willie Bio. And Willie asked me to come with him, and we was going to go out in a Lafitte skiff. Now, I'd never been in a Lafitte skiff. Well, we're going to go out in the morning.
Yeah.
So I go to his house down by your Point of Shame.
Yeah.
It is dark. I mean, it is dark. And he fires up the engine, and he just goes. And I'm in the back going, how does he know? Because you can't see.
Yeah.
And he goes, And we're going real good, and he kept looking at me, and the sun come up, right? And I stood up. I should never have stood up. Because then he made it go really fast. And he got the biggest kick out of seeing me fall back, feet in the air, and he just laughed, and I said, what do you have in this? And like I said, a big 350, it would run.
Yeah.
He didn't want to catch shrimp, yeah. He wanted to outrun them.
Yeah, we would build them light and everything else to make sure. And today's world, these skiffs are real, this is the modified stuff they have, right? You get all them big fiberglass skiffs and everything else. Now they got all them big clumps, big caliper and stuff like that. Everything was light though. Then. We were building because it was something else, man. We were growing up, man. We had speed. You know?
Well, yes.
Yeah, going from a putt-putt to 350. Yeah, that was
something else. Now, where did you get your trawl boards? Did you make your trawl boards?
We made our trawl board ourselves.
Explain to us how you made a trawl board.
Well, it's hard to explain. Just let's say you, I want to grab something like, let's that piece of paper right. I'll just show that's probably a good idea than anything else. Let's see this right here. Put this right here. That's it. It would kind of look like this here.
Okay.
We would just take, first thing we'll do, we'll take some board. Like I said, we want to make it this size here. We'll take some board, maybe some 1x6, put it like this here, about 4 of them like this here, and then we'll come back with some other board on top of them like this here.
All right.
Like this here. Right. So we got our board made. Then we wanted to make, we got a drill hole to put change in there. So what we do with this thing right there, we figure whatever we have here, the length, we figure that, then we divide that by 1/3. And then that'll tell us where we're going to go and put this hole over here. Then whatever you put this hole in the front over here, we go to the back, we measure what you got. Let's say we had 10 inches over here. Well, we don't want 10 inches over here. We're going to come over here with 8 inches over here. Then we're going to come from the top of them. We're going to come to the top over here. We're going to use 3 inches over here. So we drill a hole here, and we come back 3 inches over here and do a hole. Now, at the bottom, we do the same thing because they got, you know, we use a square. Then what we do over here, we just take it over here, and we do the same thing over here. We'll come, we had 3 inches over here, we'll come 3 inches over here. But we're not going to come 3 inches over here. We're going to come 2 inches at the bottom. We'll drill a hole right down. We put our change on. The reason, you can put the same thing, but you need less change because you can't have your board pulling like this here.
It'll block.
You got to do like this here. Yeah. So we kind of set our change so it does like this here. And when it comes up with your change, and that's what makes it open. If you got it too close, well, then it'll stay like this here. So if you got it right, if you got too much, it'll come like this here, then it's too hard to pull, and it'll jump like this. So you got to adjust. Yeah. So that was, you know, like I said, everything we did ourselves.
But that was also a lot of thought that went into all of this, too.
It's not as bad what you think. It's not bad at all. It's just the idea that it's, people don't want to tackle that, you know.
Now, where did you get your wheels? Because usually those are made of brass.
Yeah, brass. Well, those days it was all brass. Now you get stainless steel, Nibra, Aqualord, all kinds of stuff. We would pick that up out of Homa. Yeah.
All right, so there was somebody in Homa.
Oh, yeah, a Homa machine was doing that. It was just still in business then.
And they would make what you
wanted?
Well,
they wouldn't make the wheel. They would order it from other place and then come on it.
Okay.
And then, you tell them what size shaft they have, and they would have come already bored and everything else.
All right.
But that would come from other place. The place that came the most, they used to call it Michigan Wheel. It come from Michigan, you see.
Okay. All right.
Now, what about the nets, Mr. Foray? Who, you bought your nets, or did people here make them?
Well, we always made our own net, but this, when I started making that, it was easy, because you could go buy your whatever amount of webbing you want, it's already made. You know, if you want, you know, most of them come 200 miles deep and whatever length you want. Then you just cut your net, whatever shape that you want to make in it. But before I started, you would go buy some string. Just it wouldn't roll in. It was just string that would just come and just, and you had to take that string out with a needle and start with a needle and a string, and you had to make all of these holes. It would make everything. And after it's all made, then you go back and recut it. So it was time for them, time consuming.
Now, did the men do that or the women?
The women and the men, both of them did that, and the children.
And the children.
Everybody was there doing that. They just stick along. And it was made out of cotton. These net wouldn't last. You had to dip them.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you about.
It was all cotton webbing. And it wouldn't last at all. I mean, you had to really take care of them. You had to dip them, and, you know.
Dip them in what?
In tar. Mm-hmm. No, we call it net dip, but it was mostly tar those days, and you cut them with gasoline so it would be too thick. But then you had to watch, you know, if you put them in the sun, leave them in the sun too long before you use them, yeah. The sun would burn them. So it was a mess. Then all of a sudden, nylon come in. That was a blessing, man.
Do you remember when that change took place?
The nylon?
Right.
It changed to nylon in the mid-50s. Mm-hmm. By the mid-50s, it changed to nylon.
So you've seen, or you've at least heard, may not have seen, but you've heard when you went from a sail vessel to a 3 to 5 horsepower, what was it, Fairbank engine, to a Model T,
yeah.
To a Model A,
yeah.
To a Cummins diesel.
Yeah.
Is that
Cummins
fair?
Cummins diesel and all of them.
Alice Chalmers.
Oh, yeah.
And then eventually a Chevrolet.
Oh, yeah. The Chevrolet was before the Cummins and everything else.
Wow. Mm-hmm. And what kept you doing it?
Well, that was the way of living, don't you? That was the way of living. There was nothing else you could do.
But you enjoyed
everything. I enjoyed everything. Yeah, it was a blessing for me. It worked out good for me. You know, but you had to work. I mean, there was no such thing as not working. I mean, you know, if you wanted to work, you could survive.
And wouldn't you say that's true today?
It is.
I mean, if you want to work,
if you want to work, you're gonna survive. That forest stuff there, with no job, you can find something to do. Mm-hmm. And if the government would stop giving all that giveaway program, you'd have more people working.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, Don was talking about the changes that you've seen, Mr. Foray. One of the things I'd like to ask you to share with us is how the land here has changed. You were talking about, you know, people living in places that are open water now, people, you know, the land subsiding. Can you tell us what you've seen in your lifetime?
Well, again, there's so many different ways of it. Number one, they blame everything when they reroute the Mississippi River, which I think it had a lot to do with it and everything else. But we had coastal erosion before that. But when they rerouted the Mississippi River and everything, closed by LaFourche and everything else, and then the oil field come down here. They cut canal all kind of ways. There was no environmentalists telling what to do and everything. If they felt like going over the dry line, cut a canal over here, they'd cut it right there and they didn't worry about nothing. I mean, they just went over there and cut it. And the first thing you know, I mean, they just explode after that, you know. And the one thing that I can say that it did by cutting the canals and everything else, it made us more places to raise seafood. We didn't have the amount of seafood. Now it's starting to decrease. But in the 30s and the 40s and all that, even in the early 50s, we didn't have the shrimp that we got today. People said, oh, how much shrimp down there? They didn't have that much shrimp the old days. People had a hard time making a living with that. People started making money with shrimp. 1957 was the first year that the people can see it. In the state of Louisiana that they made money. And after that it got better. As all these canals opened up, changed your way of current and everything else, it made more estuaries everywhere. So it helped the shrimping, the fish, the crab. It helped them tremendously. But now you're starting to see the backside of it. We're losing all our estuaries. Now, all of these levees that they're building, this is all good. Don't get me wrong. They're caught. They got to do something to protect the homeowners and everything else. But these levees right now is good. They got to do that. But that's all going to backfire one day. I may not see it. My kid will see it. What's going to happen? You're going to have salt water. You're going to have fresh water. No more brackish water left at all. Without brackish water, you will not have any kind of seafood. But you need that brackish water. That's where all our seafood already is at. And that's coming.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you ever trap?
I did a little trap. I did a little trap, but not enough to.
Okay.
Yes, when I was young, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I had to try something, you know, but I wasn't good at that.
Well, the reason I asked.
The animal was a lot smarter than me.
The reason I asked, because, you know, when the trapping season, entire families would go out on a lease and trap, you know, November, December, January, February. So 4 months they were out. And that was when there were a lot of nutrients.
Yeah.
There's a lot of muskrat. Right. There was alligator.
Yeah.
And a man could make a few nickels. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Particularly during periods like the Great Depression. Yeah.
Some of them people made some serious money trapping that. Because the rat was worth money those days. And they were catching a lot of rat. The muskrat rat. Neutral, they didn't start catching neutral until the mid-40s over here.
Okay.
When families went out there, Mr. Foray, about what percentage of the population are we talking about? Let's say in a place like Cocodrie here.
Well, the people from Cocodrie over here wouldn't go nowhere else. They'd trap right around here.
Right,
people
but
from other places, from Chauvin, home and stuff like that, that wasn't that big percentage of that.
Okay.
That wasn't a big percentage of it.
Okay.
To say the percentage, I couldn't say it. Because according to the population of those days and the population of today, it's a different ball game, so it's hard to say, you know. But
well, it's just to have some idea, because there's nobody out there with a bean counter saying, you know, and people like us really are grappling with that, trying to figure out just how many people went out into the marsh to trap in those days.
Well, like I said, in Cocodrie over here, we probably had that would trap local around here. When Cocodrie was a lot of people and everything else, you probably had 20 people that were doing trapping. That's about all you had that were doing trapping. Then like in Chauvin and everything else, you might have had another 40, 50 people from there, but they're the one that would go into camp or home and stuff like that. They would have camp in the marsh and everything and go do that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't the percent like people think it was, you know.
Well, I think we're just about out of questions
I think you've been absolutely
well,
wonderful.
I hope I helped you some.
You have. The one thing we'd like for you to think about, one of the things that the three of us are trying to get a hold of is if you have any family photographs or anything like that that you would like to share, if you would let us know, we'll come and put it in a digital format. You keep your regimes. Because Katrina... A lot of people lost their family albums. And all of that is important. We're more than happy to do it. If you kind of... The other thing we can't find are early labels. We know that there were canneries, but we can't find the labels.
Y'all went to Sounding Canning Plant?
Where?
Y'all went to Sounding God that was doing canning plant?
Don't know that person.
I'll tell you who could help you on something like that. And he's also in the dry shrimp business. Raymond Odema out of Grand Cayo. He have high C campus. He's still in the, with his daddy was doing that. His grandfather was doing that and everything else. I would say, if y'all have time, give a call to him and he will be more than happy. His name is Raymond Odema.
All right.
His grandfather was in the business. The business he got right now is to be for his uncle. He took it up from his uncle. He got, it was used to be called Terrebonne Canning. He still got the big warehouse. And he's probably still got can, and he can tell you where the can come from that part right there.
Raymond
Odebo.
All right.
He's in Grand Cayo.
All right.
Name of the company is called High C.
Okay.
Well, we're going to do that.
We may do that this afternoon.
And he can tell you, because his grandfather was one of the guys that was one of the biggest that they had in the dry shrimp business over water. He had a huge shrimp buying platform at Point of Faro there.
On Cuatro Bayou? On Four Bayou? Where at Point of Faire?
Point of Faire is the first set of land you hit east of Shafalala River.
All right. Now, but was it on Point of Faire, or was it at one of the bayous that go through Point of Faire?
Well, it's on Point of Faire itself. In the bayou itself at Point of Faire. And coming from the Gulf, it was right there.
Okay. And it was a big platform.
Oh, it was a big platform. That was his grandfather that had that. Old man, Alphonse Odema.
Alphonse. All right.
See, you know, with the Bill Track back in time, don't you? I was going to get that when we get to the canning and everything, you know, but I mean, we were up there. But he's, and I'm sure in that warehouse that they have canning. And they have labor. And they probably still have the machine with the labor.
Hmm. Okay.
Well, we're gonna make our way out there.
We will make our way there.
Yeah, because it's the last one that had left. And Grant Cardazzo used to be a lot of them. I mean, you had, oh, Jesus Christ, you had, well, that one right there, you had the LaPel Packing Company. They're the one that invented the peeling machine.
Hmm.
That plant is still open, but it belonged to Paul Poon out of Lafitte. Somebody had bought that, and somebody, so one of somebody bought still run it for them. They may have still have some cannon outfit over there. But I know for a fact, because it's still the building, still there. I mean, it might have got down for, but Raymond got a warehouse that was high. I don't think water ever got into that warehouse.
What's going to happen to Cocoa Tree?
Me tell you, my prediction was Cocoa Tree. Once they finish with all of these levees that they want to build, Cocoa Tree going to be history. When the hurricane comes from the Gulf, or wherever the water will come from, once you got all of these levees, where can the water go besides this way here? I'm not saying next year, 10 years, 20 years. It might take 50 years or more. You know, hard to say. But Cocoa Tree going to be history. That's why I always did say, it's too late now. If they would have never built any levee in our area, we would be in a lot better shape. They started with levees, and they can't stop now. Mm-hmm. I mean, they can't stop, it's impossible. I mean, and I'm sure you all feel the same way. I mean, even when they build a highway, they want to elevate the highway. That's the levee. That. They stop your flow of the water. Look in New Orleans, I mean, everything else, even in Houma. They got levees. Well, they put a levee. There might be a 5-mile area right there that's on the levee. Where'd the water go? They got to take that water pumping on somebody else's property. Now, this guy right there, they got to do the same. You know, now, when the water comes over here, I don't care how much pump you're going to put when you're on the levee. You will never put pump that's going to pump the water that rain going to give off. And that's the problem that we have in this world. And back to this. I mean, they have to build levees to protect the way they are because they screwed it up. Man screwed it up. Man created that problem. That's not Mother Nature. That's man that created that problem.
So you're born in Cocoa Tree.
Born in Cocoa Tree.
Worked in Cocoa Tree. Yeah. And reluctantly live in Chauvin?
Yeah. But when I built in Chauvin, now I just moved to Chauvin myself just a few years ago. In fact, then I got out of shrimp business in 2000. I turned it over to my kid. But at that time, that's when But I used to live at the plant right here. I mean, I had a camp right there. That's what my home was. I didn't worry about that. Then I had a house in Chauvin. My family was raised in Chauvin. Then I built another house in 2000. But I built it a little bit further up in Chauvin, but on the opposite side of the bayou, in between the bayou and the road. But what I did, I didn't go up on piling. I pulled 400 loads of dirt, so I was on a slab. But I am, like this last, like Hurricane Katrina and all that stuff, and Rita and everything else, I could have went another 5 feet before getting water in my house. So I was born real. I knew what water could do, you know. And then they come to put the elevation and everything else, when they store everything. So they gave me a levee. I said, I want you to, the blacktop road, we just rolled it, goes. I said, I want you to throw me a lever, a line on that thing and see how high that is. So he said, well, he said, right now, he said, even like that road right now, okay, well, I'm going to go a foot and a half higher than that. He said, why you want to do that? In case we get a surge of water, I don't want that to hit that lever with that and come back in my house. I want it to go right on through it.
Good thought.
Yeah. I mean, eventually one day you will have it, you know, but I mean, it's got to be a real, real major one, you know. Mm-hmm. You never know. Enough. Just like over here, while we standing right there, when Cocoa Tree was in high, my daddy told me in 1926, when there was no even a hurricane, they had 18 feet of water over here on the ground.
Yeah, for the hurricane.
For a good example, maybe you don't know about it. You're going back toward Houma, when you get to the Texaco town, 4 miles mm-hmm. from here. Right before you get to your right, there's a little cemetery right there.
Mm-hmm.
You see a little cemetery? Mm-hmm. That used to be the Henry family right there. They drawn in 1926.
The Texaco on the right, not on the left.
The Texaco taxes to your left.
Yep.
The little cemetery is to your right.
It's across.
Right before you get there.
All right.
It'd be on the by side.
All right.
They got like a little fence made like this here. There's a blue house right here. That's a fence right there, but the front end, you'll see the cross and the cement and everything else. That's not totally. And I'm going to tell you a little story about that. The woman and the three kids was there. Old man Henry, he was an oyster fisherman. Well, he passed the hurricane over water while he was fishing oyster. He didn't come in. The people that was for Cocoa D would go out there, they stopped. They would look and say, let me pick you up and we're going to bring you up with him. Oh, no, she said, the old lady, we can't, I can't go, he said. My husband, when he come in, he found out that I rode with another man to go up, he said, he's going to beat me. He said, he's a jealous man. The woman and the kid stayed right there, and they all drowned. And they picked him up on the other side of Lake Boudreaux over there. That's why they floated in. But they could have saved them people's lives.
Mm. Yeah, well, the hurricanes are a story unto themselves.
Yeah.
You know, 1915, 1893.
Yeah.
There's a whole series that played an important role in the history of coastal Louisiana.
Yeah, it's something else what it does, you know. But like I said, they could have saved these people alive, but those days, that's how people were, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we appreciate you sharing your time with us this morning. This has been really great, Mr. Foray.
Oh, very good. Yeah. And we may call you again if we think of something later on.
No problem. Feel free to do it anytime.
It was very, very fine.
Yeah.